Chapter 3. Puritans. Kinfolk said, moved to Beverly, Massachusetts, that is. We found a large three-story home in not great shape, overlooking the ocean. The threat of urban renewal, where the government would buy out declining neighborhoods, raise them, and build new, depressed the price enough for us to buy it. I think it was something like $30,000. Since then, owners have fixed up these old homes, and they're worth 10 or 20 times as much. We could see the ocean from every floor, even the basement. On the coldest days, the seawater would steam. I thought it was great. In high wind, I could feel the house sway, which I thought was very cool, but which really meant maintenance was overdue. I could go up to the widow's walk and watch the sailboats. The house was so big, it included a one-bedroom apartment that we rented out to touring actors. One night, a tenant fell asleep while smoking and started a fire. It was put out after much excitement, and firemen and axes and smashed doors. Why use the doorknob when you have an axe? A downstairs second living room we used as my mother's art gallery, where we sold her artwork and those of our local artist friends. We rented out the garage to a guy who raced Saab cars on ice. My mother called the art studio Gallery 31, since our address was 31 Lothrop Street. I didn't know until much later that much of the reason she did it was to impress a local artist. He had recently tended faithfully to his wife as she died of cancer and was newly single. Mom was hoping that he would choose her and she could go off with him. But it was not to be, as he found someone else. Very quickly, the gallery shut down. It turned out that a lot of what didn't make sense in our family history was due to soap opera, but I didn't know until decades later. The elementary school was an easy walk away and was quite an education. Kids would ask me to say words like forest, which for me was furest. It took a couple of years to wipe the Texan out of my mouth, but it wasn't replaced with a North Shore accent. Instead, something like Ohio. Later, it took on a prep school flavor and wandered on from there, but I never again spoke with the full accent of my location. New England was still a place where people tended to live in the same place their whole lives and where the social structure reflected that. World War II marked the end of overwhelmingly static demographics, but among the older people, you could tell what town they were from by their accents. Just recently, I met a man of about 70 here in North Carolina, and I knew at once that he was from Salem. One story my dad told frequently was of a woman then in her 80s who was born in Lynn and moved about 15 miles to Manchester when less than a year old. She was still known as that Lynn woman. You can imagine the difficulties fitting in after coming from another country like Texas. One new experience about Beverly, and the North Shore in general, was the ethnic flavors. Several of our neighbors were Polish. I played frequently with the son of a Greek family a couple of streets away. Several blocks of nearby towns were Portuguese, and a very large proportion of the locals had Sicilian roots. Now, this would not have been the case if I were in Beverly Farms or Marblehead or most upscale neighborhoods, which were strictly WASP. Most people where I lived were Catholic, which was entirely novel to me. One day on the beach, the neighbor kids looked up at the sun, which was behind clouds and producing long rays in all directions, and they said, "It's the Virgin Mary!" Okay, why not? More fun than dust, humidity, and optics. They were really anxious about catechism, which made me glad to go to a church with no homework. My parents revered Pope John the 23rd, and we watched Sunday Mass televised with Cardinal Cushing from time to time. He was great. His nasal voice was unmistakable, like W.C. Fields in a dress and funny hat. I couldn't make much sense of the creed, but then I didn't do the homework. I heard about people in Massachusetts being arrested for selling condoms, whatever they were. After Pope Paul VI came along, I lost interest. It was amusing to watch the very non-Catholic Irving R. Levine on TV whisper reverently as he reported from the Vatican. Sounded like he was reporting from a golf tournament and didn't want the Pope to miss his putt. As the years progressed, I tended to identify more with the people they burned at the stake, but I was always impressed by the simple devotion and piety of the believers, which was entirely missing at my church. Away from the ocean across the street was a fairly large depression, on which the city put a baseball field. In the winter, we hosed it down and it froze, giving us a skating rink for about 4 months. I don't think we're in Texas anymore. A girl I knew about my age lived in a house on the road leading down to the depression. Her father designed and built a ferro-cement submersible that fit on a trailer. My mother thought it was shameful that a man would pursue a useless dream instead of using all of his time and effort supporting his wife and daughter. I thought it was incredibly cool. At this age, I was always designing odd airplanes and submarines and such, and thought it would be a terrible waste of a life to not try and build something extraordinary if you had the chance. Of course, my submarines were what you would expect from age 6 to 9, made with brick hulls and steam engines, since I knew about bricks and had a toy steam engine. And my airplanes ran on cod liver oil so that I could refuel at sea. But actually, I wasn't that far off. There were British steam-powered submarines during World War I, although they proved to be a very bad idea, and steam is an important part of the propulsion for many torpedoes. Some very advanced designs are now being developed for ceramic carbon fiber hulls, allowing dives to the deepest parts of the ocean, so that wasn't too bad either. And cod liver oil could be used as biodiesel fuel. Who knows? It was great to be a kid living a few yards from the beach. In Texas, in playing with my little toy trucks, I made an entire web of dirt roads in our front lawn, which I rather admired for its engineering skill and efficient layout. My mother thought otherwise. But on the beach, there were no turf limitations to my freeway fantasies. I was determined to be the first swimmer in the water in the spring and the last out in the fall by means of slow immersion and progressive numbing. The wildlife was abundant and fascinating. We could go to the end of the stone jetty, throw out a line, and probably get a fish. Nothing beats flounders straight from the water. But that was the early 60s. Since then, almost all the fish have been exterminated, and fishing from the jetty, or anywhere else in the harbor, would be a waste of time. Nothing makes me sadder when revisiting the old place than to see the ocean now mostly dead and poisoned. Even back then, I would pick up staph infections from the water. Someone interviewed one of the many professional fishermen in the area, asking, "What if there was only one fish left in the ocean? What would you do?" He said, "Go kill it." The past weighs heavily in New England compared to brand new Texas. The beach I played on was the launching spot for the Hannah, first ship of the Revolutionary Navy. When the first English settlers arrived, lobsters were so plentiful that colonists simply raked them off the beach and fed them to their hogs. No one bothered to eat them. Cod were so thick that simply lowering baskets over the side was enough to catch some. They were good fertilizer for the corn. Even in the 1940s, seafood was low class, and people in the area much preferred red meat. Schoolchildren from poor homes were given lobsters to bring to school for lunch and would throw them in the bushes out of embarrassment. Now, the cod are gone, and lobster is a delicacy. The mussels are poisoned, we can't eat them, and so they remain abundant. Sick bastards, aren't we? The winters were wild, as I'd never seen more than a dusting of snow before. I would pile on my warmest clothes and huddle alone in a snowdrift in the backyard playing Perry at the North Pole. Oh, for the thermostat of youth! Much to my future regret, I stopped taking piano in 1962 at age 7. It was just nerve-wracking and not much fun. My mother was very controlling, and I was getting rather neurotic, with chronic bedwetting and social troubles. Taking piano lessons from her was just not sustainable. I never did have whatever personality traits are required of top-notch classical performers. Thankfully, composition is a different beast altogether. I thought it was normal to simply play any music you liked between your ears, not knowing that this was quite abnormal indeed. I was a huge fan of Stravinsky, and at a very early age would conduct Firebird to a recording. I also went down to the basement of our big house with a dowel, pretended that it was a bow, and played air violin to my own imagined violin concerto. I would have to wait until 2008 for the real thing. I took a very large sheet of paper, wrote a number starting 10000000000, and filled the page with zeros. I took it to my sister and proudly showed her that I had written the largest number in the world. She said, "You could just add another zero and it would be 10 times bigger. And anyway, there was this thing called infinity that was bigger than any number you could possibly write." I found this annoying and pouted for the rest of the afternoon. It remains annoying, and probably will be so for all eternity. Second grade continued my usual career. Note that the teachers I had in nursery and kindergarten had both left teaching the year after I had them. The first grade school in Texas went out of business. My second grade teacher found a husband and left teaching the next year. Third grade was another story altogether. My teacher was mentally ill, and everyone knew it, but did nothing. I completely blanked the memory of the whole horrendous year. After my time with her, she was committed. I had done my part. Fourth grade, afterwards, my teacher moved to Germany. So far, so good. After many colds and sore throats, I had my tonsils and adenoids removed when I was 7. I had them preserved in a jar, which was the custom at the time. I stored them along with various baby teeth, 3 adult teeth removed to ease crowding, and a stash of fingernail clippings. Alas, all are now gone, gone the way of all flesh. My legacy will have to be less physical. One day in November 1963, I was coming home with friends from a day in fourth grade, making my teacher dream of other lands where people followed authority, when a man on the street told us Kennedy had been shot. I raced home and watched TV in horror for the next several days. I was acutely aware of current events from an early age and remembered Eisenhower and Kennedy's election well. I also recalled the previous October when we laughed at JFK saying, "Havana or Cuba." Grandma was in Dallas at the time of the assassination. Children my age in Denton schools cheered when told the news. I remember reporters and talking heads saying again and again, "Johnson wasn't involved," and words to that effect. Why did they keep saying that? Mao Zedong had very good spies in the U.S., and came to the conclusion early on that Kennedy had been killed by the oil kings. Kennedy had proposed a slight increase in oil taxes so the oil barons would grow rich a little slower. Their man was now president. We watched our revered Cardinal Cushing conduct the funeral. Our family had spent parts of summers at Ferry Beach in Saco, Maine, which is a Unitarian church camp back during the first residence in New England. We started going again starting in 1961 I greatly enjoyed it. I was a regular there every summer through 1972, and with occasional visits later in the 70s. More on Ferry Beach later. In February 1964, for 3 days, a unique event happened. I listened attentively to popular music. The Beatles came to the U.S. I got a transistor radio and heard every broadcast of their music I could pick up. It was quite exhilarating. After the 3 or so days, enough was enough. Why only 3 chords? Why no modulation? Why do they sing about love all the time? You! My fourth grade teacher brought an album to class recorded by Peter, Paul, and Mary with Puff the Magic Dragon and other similar songs. I protested to the point of tears, much to the consternation of the poor teacher. More reasons for her to flee to Germany. Escape to the sea in books. The allure of the ocean ran strong, and I voraciously scoured the shelves of the town library for anything nautical. This started many years of such scholarship, which was cheaper and easier than actually getting on the water. One does what is possible. Sailing takes money, strength, and social skills, while I was poor, weak, and had serious socialization problems. I especially admired books on single-handed long-distance sailing, and for many years hoped to do the same. Joshua Slocum, Vito Dumas, Howard Blackburn, and many others were my heroes, especially the ones who, like these three, worked past lack of resources or physical disability and pulled off great voyages. It's a little hard to remember what sailing single-handed offshore was like, even in the mid-60s. In today's world, teenagers circumnavigate non-stop, and if they stub their toes, well, they're on the internet. Celestial navigation skills are not necessary with GPS. In fog, there's radar. In shoals, there are depth meters. For water, there's reverse osmosis. For steering, there's autopilots and wind vanes. For power, there's solar cells or small windmills. For emergencies, there's satellite beacons. Only depth meters were available when I was 10. Now, over 100 yachts are circumnavigating at any time. By contrast, Slocum, in the 1890s, got an ancient oyster boat, fixed it up, found it could steer itself, and sailed it around the world in the first solo circumnavigation. His book is a literary masterpiece. Vito Dumas started off in Argentina in 1942 and circumnavigated in the Roaring Forties, completing in 1943. He stuffed newspapers in his foul-weather gear to ward off the Antarctic cold and was unconscious with an infection while approaching Cape Horn. Blackburn had frozen off his fingers and thumbs while rowing his dory to shore after losing contact with his ship in the fog off Newfoundland in the winter, with his dead partner stiff in the bilge. He modified a small boat and sailed it across the Atlantic in 1899, fingers be damned. None of these guys had self-steering, as was still the case with almost everyone in 1965. When sailors left harbor, few were able to keep any regular radio contact, so usually the isolation was total except for meeting passing ships, which is rare in the traditional sailing routes. If something bad happened, there weren't any satellites overhead listening for their beacons. They just didn't show up at the next port. These guys had balls. But not only that, the sensory deprivation and various austerities of diet, fatigue, and sleeplessness caused most solo sailors to hallucinate. Sometimes there was pathological breakdown, like with Donald Crowhurst's suicide in 1969 while sailing a trimaran around the world. But more common were curious, amusing, bizarre stories from people not particularly oriented toward abnormal states of consciousness. This was my first whiff of something beyond my normal awareness. Slocum had one of the best stories. He was incapacitated by food poisoning and in serious trouble when, I quote, I went below and threw myself on the cabin floor in great pain. How long I laid there, I could not tell, for I became delirious. When I came to, as I thought, from my swoon, I realized that the sloop was plunging into a heavy sea, and looking out through the companionway, to my amazement, I saw a tall man at the helm. I am the pilot of the Pinta, come to aid you. Lie quiet, Signor Captain, he said, and I will guide your ship tonight. And indeed, his boat stayed on course. The Pinta's helmsman appeared again from time to time. In a sense, and quite without intending to, these sailors were doing something similar to Bodhidharma's staring at a cave wall for 9 years before introducing Buddhism to China. Some sailors actually intended their voyage to be for self-discovery, such as my hero Bernard Mottessier. The dear reader is encouraged to look him up. Oh, why did we move? Our next-door neighbors were fixing up their houses, which would serve them very well. Mom decided that she wanted to leave, didn't want to fuss with fixing our house, and it reminded her of her studio drama. It would have been a big job lasting years, but we would have had a stable residence, apartment income, an easily paid-off mortgage, and then we'd have a very valuable piece of real estate. The potential profit would have been much more than Dad made at work. But Dad didn't want to bicker, and the local public schools were not very good, losing teachers after having me. So in 1964, we moved to North Beverly to a small home with none of the attributes of our big one on the coast. We were shocked that Goldwater won nomination and delighted that LBJ, the peace candidate, was reelected. But dark days were ahead. Boston Brahmin Louis Lyons on the public TV station WGBH mumbled about Vietnam. The three houses next door and across the street were homes to boys my age, and there was a girl also my age just up the street, so friends were easy to find. We went to a nearby elementary school where I started the fifth grade with Mrs. Puffer. My last lingering Texanism was turning Miss or Mrs. to Ms., which turned out to be prescient. Mrs. Puffer was relaxed, fun to be around, and introduced the very white-bred kids to a variety of Yiddish slang. My streak went unbroken as she married and went back to school at the end of the year. The next year was altogether different. I had the formidable Miss Smitty, a battle axe in her 60s who had seen tougher characters than me before and put them in line. She had the peculiar idea that Tenochtitlan was pronounced Tenochtitlan and insisted that we learn that again and again. School was unbearably dull, and I managed to get sick and miss as much as possible that year. On the first day I didn't show up, she fainted, fell down, and hurt her knees, so that substitute teachers had to be brought in. But in a couple of weeks, she was back. I got sick again, missed some school, and this time she broke her neck. But again, she was tough and returned in a neck brace. Sure enough, she was back again the next year, the first survivor of my school career. Maybe if I had had fewer absences, early retirement might have appealed to her more. This was the civil rights era. I was too young to know about segregation while in Texas, but my parents saw that as another good reason to leave the state. What I saw in Beverly was impressive and shocking. I would hear the neighbor boys talk about the only black student in our elementary school as that raisin, and other negative terms. This struck me as incredibly stupid. But I kept my mouth shut, knowing I couldn't change things by complaining. This was against everything I'd been brought up to believe, but I had no personal contact with anyone who wasn't white. My egalitarian ideals remained untested by reality. The local Unitarian ministers, including the one from Beverly, personally participated in marches and demonstrations in the Deep South, which was hardly a safe undertaking. Maybe they should have marched at home as well. That might have been just as dangerous. Let the fiddling commence. The public school system included string teachers and school orchestras. In November 1964, I started violin lessons with a warm Italian man named Mr. DeGeorge. Starting so late was a real disadvantage, but I was not thinking in terms of a music career. I wanted to be an oceanographer like Jacques Cousteau. But I could concentrate on music for half an hour a day and made rapid progress. Mom attended my lessons during the first 3 years and kept notes, which was most useful. The next summer, I had 8 lessons with an old man named P. Gordon Green, who was dying of stomach cancer. He was both patient and strict and an excellent teacher for me. We got a call one day canceling our lesson, and 4 days later, he went to the hospital. 2 months later, he died. His widow sold us his violin for a very reasonable sum, and I was extremely pleased with its sound. Mr. Green was the first of several people I saw die from tobacco after horrible suffering, and it made quite an impression. Dad smoked a pipe, but about this time decided to quit, which pleased me greatly. Just up the street was Doris McVan, who was a superb violinist. She had a son and a daughter about my age who were good friends. Doris played violin sonatas by Brahms and César Auguste Jean Guillaume Hubert Franck with my mother as accompanist, which I would do myself in years to come. It was quite remarkable to hear a good violin up close and in person. The contrast to even the best recording was enormous. It was magical. I continued my violin lessons at a local branch of the New England Conservatory, and after a couple of years, joined the Cape Ann Symphony up in Gloucester. I knew another skinny, bookish boy my age a few blocks away, and we hatched a plan to communicate by means of a small vehicle that would carry messages. It would hang from a wire and be powered by a model airplane motor and propeller. We couldn't figure out how to get permission to string it up along with the telephone and power lines, so I went back to frying bugs with a magnifying glass in the backyard, which was the custom at the time. The Japanese beetles infesting the rose bushes made a most satisfying pop. About this time, I started studying multi-hulls, especially trimarans. At Ferry Beach, some of the regulars got together and built an 18-foot plywood catamaran. This was my first exposure to sailboats, and I was very impressed indeed. The boat seemed huge and powerful to me, and astoundingly fast with a bright red, fully battened mainsail. My ambition became to live on a boat, however that might be possible. There was another sailboat at Ferry Beach, an old town whitecap sloop, 13.5 feet long, of lapsed drake construction, and 550 pounds, stripped down and dry. It was about 25 years old, smelled of varnish and pine, had just the feel you want from a classic wooden boat, and someone else did the maintenance. A porcupine had done a bit of gnawing at some of the strakes over the winter, but nothing fatal. Probably made it more hydrodynamic anyway. The sails were the original cotton set and had the comfortable feel of well-used pajamas, not like the plastic Dacron sails that are almost universal these days. The bluff bows and lapstrake planks made a comforting chuff-chuff sound and easily rode over the sometimes formidable chop in Saco Bay. This was one of the most enjoyable boats I'd ever had the pleasure to sail. It wasn't fast or flashy or practical or easy to launch, but it had a certain poetry of motion and harmony of function that I just couldn't get enough of. I didn't have to hang my ass over the side to keep the boat upright, and on any point of sail the tiller rested easily in my hands. That water's cold in Maine, and sometimes rough. You never know when the fog might roll in, which has happened to me. But in that boat I felt secure, and with patience knew I'd get back home. In 1965, Robert Manry put a cabin on a whitecap and sailed it across the Atlantic in 77 days. The resulting book, Tinkerbell, was quite an inspiration to me. Things were in turmoil at home. Kathy graduated from high school and left home with hopes of becoming an actress in the Boston theater scene, which filled my parents with dread. Psychedelics and cannabis were available in the arts scene in 1965, and she started to change the result, although we didn't know it at the time. When we didn't hear from her for a few months, Mom filled the information vacuum with the worst paranoid fantasies, convinced she saw her picture in a scandalous news report of hippies in New York when it was clearly not possible, thinking she must be a prostitute and so forth. It was very disturbing to witness. What would happen when I left home? My brother John left for the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in the fall of 1966, so from then on, I was the only kid at home. Also that fall, I started seventh grade at Memorial Junior High. My grandmother was spending a lot of time traveling the world and the U.S. after retirement, and she bought a wonderful leather and canvas backpack from Switzerland for me. I disposed of my book bag and used the backpack every day for school. My classmates ridiculed me endlessly while they messed with their highly inefficient bags. Slowly, backpacks caught on, coincidentally, through no influence from me, residing at the bottom of the social order. And before very long, everyone used them. As a result, I made a circular cushion and started carrying books on my head. I continued to hate school and was getting more and more neurotic and unhappy. I took some tests, did well, and earned one of only three scholarships at Shore Country Day School, a pre-prep school for the local old money Yankees. Although I had done pretty well academically, I had to repeat the seventh grade to get up to their level. This was actually just fine, since I was a year too young for my grade level. A neighbor my age, Jack Maney, also got in, and we were classmates, beginning in the fall of 1967. After months of my multi-hole fanaticism, Dad relented that summer, and we bought a Triumph trimaran, the smallest, cheapest trimaran ever produced. This was only 9 feet long, 5 feet wide, of high-impact plastic with a lateen sail. The helm was so horrendous that we broke a series of tillers and rudders just keeping the thing in a straight line. If I was sailing alone, it was fast and safe and not a bad boat, but with two on board it was extremely overloaded and thus very slow and hard to steer. This boat was the idea of Arthur Piver, who designed a series of full-size trimarans suited to amateur construction from plywood. I studied these plans and hoped to build one someday. He disappeared the next year on one of his boats while sailing alone off California. It was terrific to finally have a boat, and we attended sailing lessons at a local lake. The teacher weighed about 400 pounds, which was several times the weight of the tiny boats we used, leading to curious lists and negative freeboard. The nomenclature of even small boats is rather complex, which he simplified by calling it Norman culture. I kept an eye out for dragon boats. There we met two other students who became important players in my life. I'll call them Anton and Rose. Anton was my age, 12, and his sister Rose was 10. They lived in Beverly Farms, the part of town dominated by coastal mansions, although they lived in a modest home and had a middle-class income. Over time, we became close friends. I went with my siblings regularly to Sunday school at the local Unitarian Universalist church. My mother, with her cake-making skills, helped prepare a cake for the 300th anniversary of the congregation in 1967. Naturally, we put 300 candles on the cake, without due consideration of the consequences. When most had been ignited, it caused a miniature firestorm and mass melting. Not sure if a fire extinguisher was involved, but it was a fiasco for sure. This year, I attended a group lesson in Boston led by Shinichi Suzuki. I was by far the oldest and tallest violinist there. It was quite remarkable. He was a very warm and engaging man, and we all felt very comfortable around him. He produced a wonderful tone from his violin. I knew that I had met a master musician and teacher. Must see TV. Turn on, tune in. 1967 was the summer of love, and the psychedelic revolution was a hot topic. In November, WGBH broadcast four times in 1 week a debate at MIT between Timothy Leary and Jerome Letvin. The original faculty member who was to debate Leary couldn't make it and had to cancel at the last minute. After a mad scramble to find a substitute, they found Letvin in his laboratory experimenting with vivisectioned frog brains. He came straight from the lab in his shirt sleeves and joined Tim on stage for an extemporaneous debate. Tim started by lighting a candle, sitting cross-legged and barefoot, and spoke while a slideshow and movie projected behind him, depicting an LSD experience. I couldn't understand what he was talking about in any detail, but it was compelling and very new to me. He didn't seem brain damaged or mentally ill at all. In response, Letvin tore into him with anger, sarcasm, and vitriol, asserting, without evidence, that LSD and other similar psychedelics caused a functional equivalent of temporal lobe epilepsy and disturbed the rational process, possibly for months after a trip. Party of the first part, party of the second part. The only box I have to put this in is labeled psychosis. I rest my case. The newspapers crowed at his logical triumph, hoping to see the back of this dangerous Pied Piper Leary character. It was all very odd. My parents, church, and schools were all urging me to achieve, work hard, and become just like Dr. Letvin, and that was just fine with me. He was very smart, knew a ton of stuff, wonderful stuff, beautiful stuff. Stuff I wanted to know, too. Stuff that people admired him for knowing, that gave him a prosperous life, grateful students, and a place on the stage where he could shout bullshit on television for the first time in history. And that to a man greatly feared and hated by millions. By using my rational mind, trained with conditioned responses and memorization, someday, after many years, I too could sit in a lab and try to probe the nature of consciousness by sticking electrodes into living frog brains. All the rewards were for going in this direction, and all the punishments were for going astray. This message was all day, every day, all the more because I had aptitude for scholarship and willingness to work hard at intellectual development. And everyone in authority told me that Timothy Leary was a criminal, or, as Letvin said, a tool of Satan. But what was this life doing to me? I was angry and frustrated. No one ever talked to me about love and spirituality and kindness and compassion and serenity. I felt put down at school for being poor and weak and socially clumsy, which just made me even more neurotic. And at the end of years more to come of this training, what would I be like? Would I be angry and frustrated like Dr. Letvin? Would I have to sit in some damn laboratory making animals suffer, still dreaming of being in nature and enveloped by beauty? Or would I become an engineer laboring to make even more toys to extend the very temporary Industrial Revolution, or weapons to end it? That's what people wanted of me. Music was another realm of beauty and inspiration I longed for, but my experience of making it was rarely satisfying and frequently just made me more lonely, nervous, and afraid. It just wasn't in a spiritual context at all. It was all about competition and playing the way you were told. Tim seemed to offer another way of being, another approach that actually pointed in a direction far more attractive than Letvin's. To him, and, as I learned later, his colleague Richard Alpert, the stuff was just stuff. They had learned and taught stuff, too. Alpert called it Stuff 101. But if you say so, you lose your job, which requires believing in and promoting the value of stuff accumulation. To people in a prison who think that the prison is all there is, the worst heresy, the worst treason, is first to realize you're in prison and then try and get out. I felt trapped, and Tim was one of the only people I'd heard talking about doing something about it. I couldn't very well go to the people who ran the prison. They just wanted me to adapt and be a good inmate. But Tim's answer was completely impossible for me and incomprehensible. I never did embrace turn on, tune in, drop out. I was only 12. Where would I go? Psychological crisis. All this was working subliminally in my head. I wasn't on top of what was going on for some time yet. But what was clear was that the mental turmoil I had felt in previous years was getting worse at shore, along with social problems, and something had to be done. Seventh grade is too old to be throwing temper tantrums. My schoolmates took advantage of my weakness to see how upset they could make me. I did not have school as an excuse anymore since I went to the best one there was. The teasing that I'd endured for years in public school continued apace, so I couldn't run away from it. Somehow, I had to stop generating it. One focus of my discontent was sports. I was eager to participate and have fun on the field, especially with baseball, as I had always been too weak to keep up with my peers. I went out for catcher for much the same reason Peter Ustinov volunteered for the tank corps in World War II. He wanted to go to war sitting down. I ended up being the team photographer. Dad never could figure out why I would want to do something physical or why I was upset that it was not possible. Early in 1968, my parents started taking me to a psychologist in Salem. He was a World War II veteran of the submarine service in the Pacific and had a wonderful large sailboat. Naturally, all I wanted to talk about was his boat. When he mentioned my family life, I would break down in tears and go back to boats. He also saw my parents and eventually told Dad, "You need to get Bill away from his mother." So our hopes of my going to boarding school made even more sense now. After a few months, things eased up considerably. The psychologist had actually done us some good, without any medication, and I was coping like a good inmate in the madhouse of life. He never did take me sailing, though. The bigger the boat, the worse the manners. 1968 was a hard year for the whole country. When Martin Luther King was killed, the staid and scholarly Louis Lyons yelled, "Burn down Memphis!" while reading the news on WGBH. A lot of places did burn as I watched on TV. As a diversion from all the bad news, we had a plan in French class. Our teacher had been in the resistance fighting the Gestapo in Paris, and she spoke with a thick accent. We did whatever we could to make her say teeth, which she pronounced teets. This, to the eighth-grade mind, was far more humorous than Molière. In the spring, for my science project, I made a large solar still using my own parabolic trough design. It had a vertical axis and could tilt to track the sun. I only learned years later that it would have been much more practical with a horizontal axis. Who'd have thunk? Made the papers, was a lot of fun, actually boiled water, and, being a still, had the aura of potentially clandestine use. Scared the teachers, too, which was a bonus. John dropped out of college at this time. After many vocational adventures, he got a plumber's license and a good stable job in maintenance at University of Massachusetts. They laughed at me and called me mad, mad! But I'll show them! I'll show them all! Although no longer so freaked out, I was still an untouchable in the land of the Boston Brahmins. One spring day in the eighth grade, 1969, we were going to have a play performed at shore by a Boston theater troupe, but one of their actors was sick. So instead, the actors put on a workshop with the students with improvisation and various exercises. One such exercise was a confidence circle. About a dozen students formed a tight circle, and one stood in the middle. After closing his eyes, the central student would fall in a random direction, and the surrounding students would push him back upright. Simple, no? So I was chosen to be the first to stand in the middle. I closed my eyes, leaned back, and to the right, and fell to the ground. The students parted like the Red Sea on my approach, in horror of touching this lower-class person and his 25-cent sport coat. The actors were shocked, but I wasn't surprised at all. They replaced me with one of their own cast, and all went well. The thrift shop blazers weren't the only item of apparel that the sartorial police may have noticed. When I started at shore, all my socks were white. Cheap, easy, never a problem with matching, simple. But very 50s, so I got teased for it. Not worth the crap, says I, and I replaced them all with gray socks. But then people just thought they were the same socks, only worn out. Be that way, will you? I got white socks and black socks and wore one on each foot, yin and yang. I continued to wear various mismatched socks for about a dozen years. That spring, I got into Phillips Academy, Andover, which would be my home for the next 4 years, except for summers. As I heard the news, a patch of red traveled up and down my neck, so I must have been reacting viscerally. While I got a substantial scholarship, we still needed to pay tuition that was difficult to afford. My mother took up a part-time job selling art supplies in a local artist shop to cover the expense. While I have made severe sacrifices over the years for the sake of composition or exotic physics projects or eccentric approaches to spiritual practice, and all this in the mode of service, I have never made sacrifices for another specific person the way my parents did for me. We moved from our little home in North Beverly to the Fowler House in Danvers, the next town over. The Society for the Preservation of New England Antiquities, or SPNEA, owned the house and rented about two-thirds of it to caretakers. Four large rooms in the front of the house were kept in original condition, and we would show it to visitors over the summers. Our rent was very low, but the heating bill was huge. The house was on the Danvers River, which was tidal and only a few miles away from Beverly Harbor, so once again I lived on the water, in a house with a widow's walk on the roof. It was built in 1810 by a ship's captain for $800, had 14 rooms, 10 fireplaces, and 5 chimneys. The original name for Danversport was New Salem Village, and the people involved in the Salem witch trials had lived in my neighborhood. It was not clear to me why we would give up home ownership and move yet again, losing equity, but then I was not privy to all the details of yet more soap opera. Only after my father died did my mother tell me that she had found him in bed with a neighbor girl of about 12. I see it would have been difficult for us to stay in North Beverly after that. I was very close to my father most of the time until he died, with normal patches of difficulties. If I had known he was a pedophile, I would not have been able to associate with him unless he got serious treatment and acknowledged the problem, which he never did. He enjoyed the company of little girls. That was no secret, but I didn't realize anything beyond that. Other family members, better informed, had much more distant relationships with him. Pedophilia is an orientation, not a condition, so treatment cannot change the underlying problem. I don't know if previous firings and moves were rooted in this behavior, but it seems likely. Better than prison, although that would have protected the girls involved. I met a physicist for the first time that summer at Ferry Beach, complete with goatee and sandals and impressive wild gray hair. His name was Marvin White. He gave me a copy of a paper he'd written about jet streams on the sun, which had all kinds of funny squiggles and Greek letters. Very impressive. He also had an operatic baritone voice. Music and physics! What do you know? One day, an amusement park 4 miles away, Old Orchard Beach, burned down. We put his 4-inch reflector telescope on the beach and watched as the smoke went straight up for a mile or two. It was a clear, windless day, or we'd have sailed over for a closer look. I watched the first moon landing at Ferry Beach. Dad made parts for quite a few spacecraft, including the lunar excursion module, so I had a personal interest in the Apollo missions. My hair had been a buzz cut, no more than half an inch long, my whole life. Now came the time to go with the flow, and for the months leading up to Andover, I let it grow. What changes in my head would this foretell?